County of Broomfield versus the Farmers Reservoir and Irrigation, and we're ready to hear from the appellant.
Morning, Your Honor. Morning, Justices. I'm John A. Colt III. With me is John C. A. Colt, appearing on behalf of the appellant Farmers Reservoir and Irrigation Company. This is an appeal from the award of costs and fees in a water court application for change of water right that was initiated by the City of Broomfield and Pulte Homes, changing senior water rights from irrigation to municipal uses. The substantive determination in that case was previously appealed to this court in SA 09 SA 178, and is presently pending decision. This is a separate appeal on the award of costs and fees because by the time that the costs and fees was determined by the court, the original decision was final and was already on appeal in this court. So the costs and fees determination came up separately, and as it came up separately, the clerk advised us that it should have a separate number, separate case, and be treated as a separate appeal. So while it is related to the pending appeal, this is separate. We're aware, of course, in raising the constitutional issues concerning the award of costs and fees in a water court application, of this court's decision in Fort Morgan versus GASP, 85P3536, a decision in which this court did affirm the award of costs and fees against a mutual ditch company. However, a review of the pleadings and briefs in that case, as well as a review of the decision, discloses that the arguments raised and the constitutional issues that are raised in this appeal were neither raised nor considered by the court in the Fort Morgan case. Therefore, we believe that the arguments presented in this case on this appeal are not precluded by the decision of this court in the Fort Morgan case.
So can I ask you whether there's an unintended consequence of your arguments in this case? Because a mutual ditch company is basically a private organization, and these ditches hold the greatest reservoir of private property rights and water. Doesn't your argument and what you'd like the court to do kind of make them a public, even municipal corporations, if a municipality has bought into a mutual ditch company?
We have raised the question of whether or not the representative capacity of a mutual ditch company that is recognized by this court, particularly in the Jacobucci versus district court decision, makes us basically a representative or an agent for the shareholders. And we have raised that issue in this case, that where this court in previous cases has disregarded the corporate structure of mutual ditch companies by way of discovery, by way of due diligence, and looked directly to the shareholders for a determination.
Well, that's to make sure they got due process.
Yes.
And that the board of directors wasn't able to dispose of their pro rata interest in the ditch structure and the water rights without them actually being able to access being brought into the litigation. Right. Isn't that correct?
Well, in that case, there was a, particularly in the discovery case, where the court disregarded the corporate structure of the mutual ditch company. They said that the impetus for the application was based upon the shareholders' intent and claim, and therefore they said that is who you can go depose and who you can look to determine what the appropriate intent was, not the intent of the representative ditch company. But in this case, we're not arguing that we are to be considered to be a public entity for the purposes of Rule 54D. What we're arguing is the disparity of treatment of ditch companies and private water right owners in the assessment of costs and fees in a water right case, as compared to government entities, is an unconstitutional discrimination between a private entity, private water right owners, and public entities that are participating in the same process and in the same capacities. As I will address shortly, municipalities and districts, when they are in the water court proceeding, are by and large in a proprietary capacity. And even more so, as more popularly being done, they participate through water enterprises, which are non-taxpayer funded, revenue-based public enterprises that act exactly in the same manner as private corporations. They are premised upon private revenues, supporting their operations. They're providing a non governmental service. It's not like police and fire, where you call a fireman and they come out and they don't ask if you paid your bill. When they provide water services, they only provide it to those people that contract with them and pay their bills. That is a proprietary action. It's not a governmental function. So that is where the unconstitutional disparity that we will address comes into play. So in answer to your question, we're not arguing that we are in fact public. We're arguing the disparity of treatment between public and private parties in a water court proceeding based on both First Amendment and Fifth Amendment equal protection arguments and the Colorado corollaries of Article 2 in the Colorado Constitution, Sections 10, 24, and 25. There is in this case a threshold issue to be presented. As the record reflects, when the case was determined and a motion for fees and costs was submitted, Franco requested a hearing on that, raised the constitutional issue or constitutional claim, gave notice to the Attorney General, who did in fact come in without objection as a party. And there was a hearing date that was set for hearing Franco's position with regard to the assessment of fees and costs. While we were waiting for that hearing, without briefing or argument, the water court on its own rejected Franco's argument, citing Central versus Simpson as the basis for its decision on the pleadings. Central versus Simpson was a case in which the exemption of the conservancy district was acknowledged by this court and affirmed as being a political subdivision of the state, which shows perhaps that the court misapprehended what our argument was. As you were suggesting, Justice Hobbs, the argument is not challenging the exemption of the state, which is what Central was about, or its subdivisions. The argument is about this disparity of treatment. But nonetheless, the court did, in fact, reject our argument, reject our position and constitutional claim before hearing.
Counsel, can I stop you there? And yes. Just to follow up on your disparity of treatment idea, I mean, help me understand an equal protection, your equal protection argument, in the sense that don't we always treat government different? I mean, isn't a government entity treated differently in a whole host of...
Not always, and particularly when...
Well, how about just sovereign immunity?
Sovereign immunity, as a judicial matter, was abrogated by Evans versus Board of County Commissioners in 1971. This court found that the time had passed where the concept of sovereign immunity as a judicial function should no longer be the law of Colorado, if it ever was, as the court said in that case. So on a basis of sovereign immunity, this court has rejected that concept. Now, I do acknowledge that the court has, nonetheless, continued with Rule 54D that acknowledges that the state and state subdivisions are not subject to the assessment of costs and fees. So be it. We're not challenging that. What we are challenging is when we are participating in the same proceeding, that for one block of applicants or opposers to be exempt from crushing engineering fees and costs, and the other side not, that is where the equal protection claim comes in. And in addressing the court specifically, the question on the equal protection, where it relates to a First Amendment right to of free speech and to petition the government in the water court process, that's a fundamental right.
So are you saying, but you say it's not strict scrutiny?
It is strict scrutiny because...
I thought you said it wasn't strict. You conceded
no,
it wasn't.
We say it's...
This is a strict... In other words, the Equal Protection Clause standard you're arguing for is strict scrutiny?
Yes, Your Honor. And the reason why we are arguing that it's a strict scrutiny test is, strict scrutiny, as the court is aware from Tattered Cover versus the City of Thornton and the ARC cited in our brief, is where there is a suspect class or where there is a fundamental right at issue. The measure of the limitation on the constitutional right is strict scrutiny. We're not arguing that we are a suspect class, at least for Rule 54B purposes. Ditch companies aren't in the suspect class area, but we are arguing, and we believe that the law is clear that we have a fundamental right at issue, a fundamental right to participate, whether or not a party has any water right interest at all. This court has recognized that there is standing in the Buffalo Park case. It says there's broad standing to address the water
quality. Could you discuss a little bit the implications if we accept that argument for other constitutional rights? I'm sorry, can you not hear me, Mr. Stakeholder? Could you discuss the implications for other constitutional rights that are present? That's assuming that you have a constitutional right to oppose. Certainly, water law, the notion of water law is embedded in our Constitution. But we don't say that for every constitutional right that automatically gives you a First Amendment right.
No.
And is entitled to strict scrutiny.
That's correct. But as this court has said in Buffalo Park Development versus Mountain Mutual, it said specifically regarding the broad standing, which is the constitutional basis for the argument, it said allowing broad standing for, quote, persons, close quote, to appear in opposition to an application brings to the water court facts and arguments that aid the water referees and judges in carrying out their public roles, allowing them to make informed rulings and judgments concerning allocation, use, and administration of the public's resource. That is why there is a...
How do you equate that with the First Amendment right?
Well, because you have the right to petition the government with regard to the allocation and use of a public asset. And the water court is the only forum that the Water Right and Determination Act of 1969 provides for persons to be heard on the allocation of a public resource. It is the same as if an executive decision was made concerning the allocation of a public resource, except in Colorado, the legislature has put that act over to the judiciary instead of the executive department. But no one would assert that your right to petition the legislature or to petition the executive with regard to the allocation of a public resource is anything other than the constitutionally recognized right to petition the government on a matter of public interest. And the fact that it's a judicial function in Colorado does not negate the right to petition that portion of the government that has been allocated the duty to allocate a public resource. That's why it is, in fact, a fundamental right. Two particular examples that I can raise for the court that perhaps clarify First Amendment rights involved. In 3792.305, sections 4 and 5 provide for consideration of water quality in certain change of water right cases and in exchange cases. So where the court is to make a determination and consideration of water quality issues in a change of water right case, that involves interests far more broad than simply the water right users and water right decree holders in a particular case. Any group or person that is interested in water quality has the right to appear and to present their position in support or in opposition of an application concerning the effect on water quality. Similarly, the Colorado Water Conservation Board has been empowered by the legislature to adjudicate minimum stream flow claims. And I believe the statute says something along the lines, to preserve the natural, to preserve nature to a reasonable degree. That's a broad standard, but anyone that is interested in the preservation of the natural condition to a reasonable degree has a right to appear before that court and to assert what their position is in support or against the Water Conservation Board's application for minimum stream flows. That is not involving directly any water right claim that the participant may have. It is a recognized right for that person to come before the court and say, that supports sufficiently the natural condition, and we support the natural condition. That is a First Amendment petition. That's a First Amendment right to appear in that context and in that forum, and that's why it's a fundamental right that is involved.
Mr. Well, could you address the issues raised by your opponents that you didn't raise the First Amendment issue in the trial
court? Yes. I was going to get there when I said there is a threshold issue.
Right.
And the threshold issue is, as I noted, prior to the hearing, the court on the pleadings without argument or briefing rejected Trico's constitutional argument. By the date of the hearing, the state, the Attorney General's office, had become a party and had filed a motion in limine to limit the presentation of Franco's position at the hearing on attorney's fees. And at the morning of hearing, the court granted the state's motion in limine and precluded us from presenting our constitutional position expressly. That was the purpose of the motion, and that was the court's ruling. So we agree that we did not present the factual predicate or present our full panoply of constitutional arguments before the water court because we were expressly precluded by the motion in limine filed by the state and granted by the court for that hearing. So we were not able to make our factual presentation. What we would request in that regard is if this court determines that it can't validly address the constitutional issues because we did not and were not permitted to make our argument before the water court, we ask that this be remanded so that we can make a proper.
Ms. Rangel, could you just sort of separate that out for me? Because a moment ago you talked about being precluded from making your factual presentation.
Yes.
You also talked about being precluded from making your argument. And you also talked about being precluded from raising the issue, I think.
No, we weren't.
Those seem to me to be three separate things. Okay. I'm a little bit more concerned, I think, about whether you raised the issue.
We raised the issue of unconstitutionality and gave notice of unconstitutionality.
That's kind of broad.
We expressly tied it to the due process and equal protection claims in the motion for the hearing. We were ready to present that issue, that is the due process and equal protection claim in the hearing, but inextricably tied to that is the First Amendment claim. As noted in our reply brief in City of Chicago versus Mosley, a disparate treatment of First Amendment rights constitutes a claim under equal protection that is to be considered by the court. So they are inextricably linked. The First Amendment on its own legs and the First Amendment as the predicate fundamental right for consideration of strict scrutiny in the equal protection context.
So do I correctly understand that you're saying that by raising the First Amendment issue, you necessarily raise the equal protection
by
issue?
By raising the equal protection argument, we necessarily raise the First Amendment.
Okay.
And
is that always true? So that if we rule in your favor on this, henceforth, anyone raising an equal protection issue also raises any First Amendment issues?
If the equal protection argument is based upon a disparate treatment of the First Amendment right, I think that's the distinction.
Even if that's not apparent in
if the equal protection argument does not arise from the disparate treatment of a fundamental right, then obviously
the fundamental right. Was that apparent in your motion?
Pardon?
Was it apparent in your motion that you were alleging that the disparate treatment
yes.
arose from the from a fundamental right?
Yes, but we were not permitted to make that argument because of the motion in limine that was granted. We were limited expressly to a consideration of whether or not the costs and fees were reasonable.
Can you just be a little more explicit about in what way that was apparent in the motion?
The notice of constitutionality, it wasn't a motion, it was a notice of claim of unconstitutionality. The notice of the claim of unconstitutionality expressly provided for the claim that there was an unconstitutional equal protection argument because ditch companies and private litigants in a water court proceeding are subject to costs and fees, whereas the public entities are not. The argument then that we were not able to make was
The tie-in in the notice to the First Amendment?
The notice was made on equal protection. The substance of the argument that we were not permitted to make is why is it an equal protection argument? Why is it a strict scrutiny?
But a moment ago when I asked you about whether when you raise an equal protection issue, if that always necessarily is sufficient to raise a First Amendment issue, I thought you told me it is if it's apparent that it's necessarily based on that First Amendment claim or related to that First Amendment.
Which would have been apparent if we would have been entitled to
but it wasn't
make
apparent
our
in the notice. But it would have been apparent if the argument were made.
Exactly.
All right.
We made the substantive notice. The basis of it was never presented. Because we were precluded from presenting it because of the state's motion that was granted. So that's the problem. So if we do have a lack.
And you don't think that there's any requirement that it be raised in the motion as opposed to in the argument?
We didn't raise it as a motion. We only raised it as a notice of claim of unconstitutionality, and we had not yet briefed it. We had not presented it. We had made no arguments about it. We did not present our position, and the court did not have that in front of it when it cited Central versus Simpson.
And the question is, you don't think there is any obligation and to preserve the issue by raising it in the notice?
Not in the notice. Our notice was on the claim of unconstitutionality of equal protection, and before the court asked what the basis of that was, it ruled against our position. Court didn't inquire what the basis, what the level of scrutiny is, and what the basis of our claim was before it ruled against us. So that's why I'm saying, if it is important to this court, the proper thing would be to send it back to the trial court so that we can have a proper predicate for this court to consider both the First Amendment on its own legs. But in any event, the First Amendment claim comes in under the notice equal protection argument, because that is the fundamental right upon which the equal protection claim is based. That was made, that was noticed, and the question there is, does that mean that the level of scrutiny, because a fundamental right is at issue, is strict scrutiny, not reasonable basis? So that is the basis for what the argument is.
Well, let's assume we reach it here. Yes. You're at the back end of litigation now, disputing a cost
yes.
amount, any cost amount, the way I read it.
Yes.
Now, how is that an impermissible, unconstitutional infringement on the right of access to the water court? You basically, we're in the water court.
Yes.
Made your arguments. You could have prevailed, right?
We could have, but we wouldn't be able to get our cost back.
No, I understand that argument, but would you focus in right now on why the charging of costs of the participation in the proceedings?
Yes.
You know, apparently the outcome you want is that nobody would ever be charged any cost
yes.
in a water proceeding.
Yes.
Now, you tell me why that's a fundamental right that's connected with your guaranteed right of access under the 69 Adjudication Act.
The guaranteed right of access, and as this court has noted, the broad standing that acknowledges that a party does not even have to have a water right to have valid standing in a water court application, means that.
Can I just interrupt you
yes.
to ask you a question, Mr. Acold? Under the 69 Act, that's statutory, right?
Correct.
It's not constitutional.
No.
So where do we get the fundamental basis, premise of your argument?
The court has, where we get that from.
Just because we have standing for lots of things.
Well.
It doesn't have to be constitutional standing.
No, it doesn't have to be constitutional standing, but where you have a forum, a state forum for allocation of a public right, it is the equivalent of going to the legislature to argue in favor or against particular legislation. And being assessed the other side's costs and fees. It's akin to going to a zoning hearing and being heard on a zoning application and the zoning board ruling against you, and on that basis saying, and you're now going to pay all the architectural and engineering fees that the proponent of this project has incurred. It's exactly the same, because in the context of a water right adjudication, there are public rights involved, and therefore you have a right, a constitutional right, even though the process is statutory, you have a constitutional right to address the government that is allocating a public resource.
Without cost?
Well, you can't assess the party the cost for petitioning the government any more than if you petition the government in the executive or legislative branch. They can't, or the government can't, assess you for costs for doing so.
Can the court charge you a fee for an application?
Well, absolutely. And it's equal. And there's no disparity.
Well, let's suppose the legislature said that governmental entities, for instance, the United States, don't have to pay it if that was their decision.
Well, there's different issues with regard to whether or not a state can impose a fee on the United States. But under the McCarran Act, perhaps they can. But absent that, I doubt where the U.S. is involved, whether the state can impose costs on the
United States. But you're conceding now that the state or the court can require municipal entities to pay a fee.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes, they can, as long as they don't say, "Oh, you're a private applicant, you have to pay a fee of $1,000," and for the same exact application, have a municipal enterprise do the same exact thing, and they get to pay $10. Now, that wouldn't be quite as critical because that doesn't necessarily totally infringe upon the right to be heard. But nonetheless, that would be a disparity that I would think would be troubling. But
counsel, before you,
yes.
can I just ask you, have you, it seems to me that you're making an alternative argument in your briefs too, that if you do not succeed on the constitutional arguments, that somehow costs could not be assessed against you under 54D because you are a government entity? Are you still making that
argument?
No,
we're not arguing that we're a government entity. What we're arguing on that regard is ditch companies have been disregarded in their corporate structure, and you look to the shareholders, and we have a majority of municipal shareholders who are in fact exempt. So if we are their representative in a water court proceeding, as the Jacobucci case says, then it's not our exemption that we're claiming. It would be the exemption of our municipal shareholders. That would be the argument.
Okay, but so you're not abandoning that?
No, I'm not abandoning it, but I'm not trying to we only have a limited amount of time here, so I'm trying to express what I would consider to be the broader and more important constitutional issues involved in this appeal.
Hey, with that, just one second. I thought at the beginning you were expressly abandoning that.
I'm not expressly abandoning
54D. So coming back to Justice Hobbs' initial question, about the effect that it would have as characterizing yourself as a public entity, you're still making that argument that you, in effect, are a public
entity. We're not claiming a public entity. We're claiming that under Jacobucci, on that particular argument, we are a representative of public entities. Not that we are a public entity, but we are a representative of public entities. That's what the Jacobucci case said.
Therefore, are accepted under 54D.
Therefore, disregarding the corporate entity, as this court has done in other contexts in the water court process, if you look under 54D and disregard the corporate structure of the ditch company, you look to the shareholders, are they exempt or not?
Can I follow up with one other question real quick?
Sure.
If the last argument you were making, just before we went off to the side a little bit here, if participating in water court is tantamount to petitioning the legislature, which I took was your sort of analogy there.
It is.
Then where's the equal protection issue involved here? What difference does it make whether the government is not bound by the same criteria?
If you're walking out from the legislative hearing after having had your say and petitioned the government, and you get hit with the other side that was also petitioning on the same issue in a contrary position, and they send you a bill for their costs associated with raising their argument, because you participated in that legislative process, that's where the equal.
Does that imply that if they didn't treat the government differently, you could be charged for petitioning the legislature?
If they didn't, I'm sorry, what?
Is your only objection that the government is being treated differently? But does that imply that that one could be charged for petitioning the legislature as long as the government?
I think that's a direct infringement on First Amendment rights.
And therefore, being charged for participating in water court without regard to what applies to the government, is that also a direct infringement?
That's the First Amendment right, not because we're a public entity, but because it is a chilling effect.
And so now are you raising a separate First Amendment claim that's different from your equal protection claim?
No. We're saying that the fundamental issue that arises for the strict scrutiny is because it's an equal protection argument. There's one important part, and I'm running low on time, but in the Fort Morgan case, this court made the distinction between the referee process and the water right process after re-referral. As the court is aware, when a water court's application is filed, it goes to the referee, and there's an informal process, and at some stage, it can be re-referred to the water court. That's the switch in the Fort Morgan case that the court said, this is not judicial, this is judicial, after it has been re-referred to the water court, to the water court judge. We were just last week set for trial in a water court application of June of 2012. Under water court rule 11B5, the engineering for that case by the applicant won't be presented to us until late summer of 2011. Now, over the next year, from now till then, the applicant is going to be spending tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars to prepare their case. If that is the switch, and we haven't even been heard on that case yet, if all of a sudden the hours are rolling and the time is running because we are now subject to being assessed fees and costs for a report that we won't get for the next year, either the court is asking us simply to sign off on an application that we have absolutely no engineering basis to do so, or we're subjecting ourselves to ruinous risks. If that case goes, we get the engineering a year from now, even if we settle out, the applicant can say, I had to go to this expense to prepare these engineering reports, and I'm going to be the prevailing party if you stipulate. I get all my expenses back. That's an impossible situation to put private litigants into. Anybody would be foolish. You know, we're in the case, maybe we are foolish. But it'd be foolish for a ditch company, it'd be catastrophic for an individual to stay in that case and to be subjected to costs and fees at the end of the period in which the initial information is provided. So I would ask the court to take into account the real life situation on where it said a case becomes litigation instead of a petitioning matter, and on that basis consider that it can't possibly be when the case is referred back to the water court as it becoming a judicial matter, because we have no control over what the costs and expenses are for an applicant preparing to present for the first time a basic engineering. And I recognize my time is out, so unless there's any further questions, I appreciate the attention of the court.
May it please the court, my name is Chad Wallace. I'm an assistant attorney general. With me is Autumn Bernhardt, also from the attorney general's office. I'm here today representing the attorney general for the state of Colorado in defense of Civil Rule of Procedure 54D. I will be addressing two main issues before you this morning. First is FRICO's due process and equal protection arguments. Second is FRICO's argument regarding free speech and right to petition government. Mr. Keeter is representing the city of Broomfield, and he will be following me discussing the issue of why FRICO as a mutual ditch company does not qualify as a state, an officer, or agency thereof for the cost exemption in Rule 54D. To begin with, I think I should clarify in talking about the due process and equal protection arguments that FRICO is making an argument based only on the exemption of costs afforded to the state, its officers, and agencies. And this is made clear in FRICO's opening brief when they say it is the disparate treatment of public and non-public participants in a water proceeding that violated the equal protection and due process provisions of the United States and Colorado constitutions. Therefore, it is not simply the imposition of costs under an equal protection or due process argument, but the state exemption from costs that raises the issue brought by FRICO under due process and equal protection. FRICO is not making an as-applied challenge. It seems rather FRICO is making a facial challenge to the exemption afforded states, their officers, and agencies. Because of that, this court should presume the rule is constitutional. And because FRICO is challenging that rule, it faces a burden to show that it is not constitutional beyond a reasonable doubt. Moreover, FRICO must also show that there is no circumstance in which the exemption to states could constitutionally be applied. It has not done so either in its briefing or argument today. Finally, this court should review the due process and equal protection claims under a rational basis standard. There is no fundamental right implicated here. Essentially, the argument that FRICO was making is that there is a fundamental right to cost-free litigation. That right does not exist as a fundamental constitutional right. The fundamental rights, as outlined in the state's answer brief, are limited to First Amendment rights, the right to marry, the right to procreation, interstate travel, the right to pursue a lawful business, and the right to vote. The right to free lawsuits is not a fundamental right.
Counsel, can I say, so I take it that you reject the characterization of this as a First Amendment claim?
I do. If Your Honor would like me to get into the First Amendment issue.
Right. I understand I'm taking you away from your organization, but I'm just wondering, I mean, can you help me understand why is this not a First Amendment issue?
Yeah. Putting aside whether that issue is preserved for the moment, I do not believe, and FRICO has not shown, that there is a First Amendment right implicated here. There is no denial of access to courts. FRICO's argument is essentially in a position of costs in and of themselves have denied it the access to courts under a 1969 Act proceeding. That obviously is not the case. That is one reason why it was assessed cost. It had participated in court and it had its say. This court has already ruled on that issue in the Fort Morgan versus Gasp case. It delineated under the 1969 Act, even though the application for appropriation of water rights and a change of water rights goes through the water court. This court held that there's essentially a dual process or a two-tiered process that goes on. The counsel for FRICO is correct in that any person can file a statement of opposition. That's consistent with the Shirola case, whether or not you own a water right. Anyone can file a statement of opposition, and that person can participate in the informal conferences before the water rights referee. Participating before the referee does not subject any party to the imposition of costs. Under the Fort Morgan case, only once that case has been referred back to the water judge does it become litigation. At that point, parties are conducting formal discovery, holding formal hearings, and essentially conducting a lawsuit. At that point, Rule 54D attaches. The Fort Morgan case made that clear.
So Wallace, what about his applied challenge to the example he gave where he has, where to protest in litigation, you don't get an engineering report for a year and a half?
It seems to me that...
So you really don't know what you're getting.
Well, it seems that that's
without part spending of, a lot of money.
Well, that's part and parcel of the informal nature of proceeding before a referee. Parties are not precluded from talking with one another. It's rather common for engineers, parties, water managers to have that discussion before the referee to try and keep costs down, to do it outside of the courtroom. Once, however, parties decide to re-refer that matter to the water judge or to protest a referee's ruling, which they have the right to do, then it becomes a lawsuit. Counsel for FRICO made an analogy of a zoning hearing, petitioning the government in that aspect. Participating before a water court referee is not that dissimilar. However, if a party wants to file a lawsuit to challenge the result of the zoning hearing, they're free to do that, but they're not guaranteed the ability to do that cost-free. Proceeding before the water court referee is very similar. You can file a statement of opposition, proceed informally before the referee. However, if you want to take that to the next step, that becomes lawsuit, and then you're subject to the imposition of costs. There's nothing in the 1969 Act or in the Uniform Local Rules for Water Courts that exempts participation before the water judge from Rule 54D.
But then, can I just, now you've brought us back to the equal protection, correct? I mean, I think I'm accurately restating their argument, which is once you're in the litigation, it's not a level playing field at all, because there's a huge kind of cost potential hanging above one party, and the other party doesn't have that. I mean, so can you address that? I mean, there's certainly a difference, but how is that a constitutionally acceptable difference?
There certainly is a disparate treatment between the state, its officers and agencies under Rule 54D, and parties that don't qualify as a state entity for purposes of that rule. I'd like to say first that there is no fundamental right involved. So the due process is not a strict scrutiny, but rather simply a rational basis, in which case we're examining whether there's a reasonable, whether that disparate treatment is reasonably related to a legitimate government interest. In this case, there are at least two reasonable government interests, the first being sovereign immunity. The state is the actor that creates the courts. It does not also need to subject itself to liability in the imposition of costs in those same courts. The U.S. Supreme Court in Alden versus Maine upheld that doctrine of sovereign immunity for states in their own courts. Secondly, another legitimate governmental purpose is fiscal certainty. This court upheld in the Simon versus State Compensation Insurance Authority case that the state could treat itself differently. That was an examination of the Colorado Governmental Immunity Act dealing with torts and the exemption from states from liability from certain torts and certain procedures that needed to be followed when suing a state actor. That was disparate treatment, but this court held that because of the sovereign immunity and the fiscal certainty policies, that disparate treatment was acceptable and not a constitutional violation.
I follow up on this. Suppose we change our rule based on this inequity argument. We've heard it often. We had a case in the San Luis Valley involving the rules and regs and the playing of this rule. What if we were to change it to require that local governmental entities would pay costs if they lose all or part of the issue? Would that be constitutional?
In that case, this court would simply be applying the rule as it had been changed. What we have here is FRICO challenging...
Can you answer that? Could we adopt such a rule that would make the playing field more level in the way that Justice Ide was talking about?
I do not believe that would be a violation of the Constitution. Rule 54D already provides that the state is exempt from costs unless a statute provides otherwise. So in that case, if we have a directive of law providing otherwise, as there are in some circumstances in other statutory provisions, that would in fact be acceptable.
So you're saying that the state legislature could override the rule?
The state is free to waive its sovereign immunity in circumstances it sees fit. In this case, it has not seen fit to waive that immunity. Want to make sure that I've covered all the issues here. Want to backtrack and again reiterate that what FRICO is making an argument for in the due process and equal protection arguments is a right to cost-free litigation. That is not a fundamental right. And I think I've explained adequately how this court has already held in the Fort Morgan versus Gasp case the multi-tiered process so that parties are afforded access to the court. FRICO's opening brief did raise some issues which it seemed to try and characterize as a right that it was protecting. That is, the right to protect its water rights and the right to have a voice in the allocation of a public resource. These are the exact same arguments this court considered in the Fort Morgan versus Gasp case and held that imposition of costs in the 1969 Act proceeding did not, in fact, chill those underlying rights. Moreover, the rights to access to the courts is not a fundamental right.
Let me ask you this. Let's assume there's discretion in the water court whether to award costs or not. Is there in the rule?
Yes.
It can refuse to do so.
Yes, certainly. So
is it unconstitutional in your view to have a discretionary scheme in that respect? It seems that that the opposing counsel basically would not contemplate that.
There is nothing unconstitutional in allowing the court discretion in awarding costs. That is specifically provided for in this rule. That is one reason why FRICO, by necessity, is making a facial challenge rather than an as-applied challenge. Some of the arguments made previously are that smaller entities would essentially be precluded from participating in water court because of the specter of imposition of costs.
That they can make their argument to the water court under the rule that they shouldn't be assessed costs because
exactly.
They've contributed to the conversation.
The court,
that leads to the court's judgment.
Yeah, the court is allowed under Rule 54D to basically balance the equities, to determine which party is prevailing, to what extent of the case, and further, what amount of costs to assess in awarding to the prevailing party and then what costs to assess against the non-prevailing parties. That provision, that discretion is already built into Rule 54D.
Counsel, as you go through that, can I ask you to address whether or not the question was, or the constitutional questions were actually raised? And specifically, can I get you to address whether or not we should remand for consideration because there wasn't, I believe Mr. Acold argued that there really wasn't any fair consideration of the constitutional issues in the case.
Certainly, I presume Your Honor is asking a question regarding FRICO's free speech and right to petition arguments. The position of the state is that FRICO failed to preserve that issue for review on appeal.
Right, so I guess your position is that we can consider the equal protection argument, but not the First Amendment argument?
Correct. FRICO did raise in numerous pleadings equal protection and due process arguments. FRICO mischaracterizes the proceedings below. The state, through the Attorney General, did file a motion in limine, which was to restrict the scope of the hearing on costs. The court, trial court below, did hold a hearing to determine the reasonability of costs. That motion in limine did in no way prevent FRICO from raising a constitutional issue directed towards the free speech or right to petition arguments. In fact, FRICO filed 4 different papers with the trial court in which it raised constitutional arguments. First, FRICO filed a response to the bill of costs and notice of unconstitutionality. This is the pleading by which the state attorney general became aware of what constitutional issues FRICO was raising. Second, FRICO filed a motion for reconsideration of costs. Third, it filed a response to the motion in limine. And fourth, it filed its notice of appeal. In none of these 4 filings did FRICO raise free speech or right to petition arguments. It raised numerous other arguments, including equal protection, due process, Section 1983 claims, and the implied commerce clause. Nowhere did it raise a free speech issue. Moreover, the trial court provided FRICO an opportunity to submit additional briefing. FRICO did not. So the motion in limine in no way precluded raising the argument. While evidence of constitutionality was not presented at the costs hearing, FRICO had a full and fair opportunity to raise constitutional issues in numerous pleadings with the court. It didn't do so. The first time the state saw the free speech and right to petition arguments was in FRICO's opening brief with this court. If I can backtrack for a minute, going back to the equal protection arguments that FRICO is asserting, FRICO, in the first instance, needs to be similarly situated in order to raise an equal protection argument. It is not. justification that I explained earlier for the disparate treatment includes sovereign immunity and fiscal certainty for a governmental entity. FRICO is not a governmental entity, does not provide governmental services, nor does it enjoy any level of sovereign immunity. Because of that, it is fundamentally different than the state, its officers, or agencies. And disparate treatment is reasonable in that case. Because of that, its equal protection argument fails from the beginning. Even though FRICO has failed to preserve its free speech arguments, I would like to go into a little bit if this court wants to consider the free speech argument, in that FRICO is alleging that its free speech rights are somehow chilled by the imposition of costs, even though it had access and did participate in the water court proceeding. This court has already explained in the Fort Morgan versus Gasp case that imposition of costs are reasonable. Even in a 1969 Act proceeding, this court has upheld in at least 3 separate cases the imposition of costs, and in addition, the exemption of states from the imposition of costs under Rule 54D. That's the Fort Morgan versus Gasp case, the Central versus Simpson case, and and the FRICO versus Golden case. In fact, in the FRICO versus Golden case, FRICO was assessed costs, whereas one of its shareholders, who was a municipality, the city of Thornton, as an example, was exempted from the imposition of costs under Rule 54D. It is really not a new issue for this court to consider. Moreover, the restriction of free speech is acceptable depending on the forum that is considered. This court has held, just in 2007, in the People versus Aleem case, that a courtroom is not a public forum, that restrictions upon free speech are reasonable. In that case, the court upheld a restriction on the clothing that a criminal defendant could wear. This court held that because a courtroom is not a public forum, that there is lesser protection afforded to free speech rights, and that in a court, restrictions upon speech can be imposed if, first, they are reasonable, and second, they are not because of opposition to the speaker's viewpoint. A combination of the Aleem case with the Fort Morgan case, which allowed the imposition of costs in a courtroom, clearly shows that in litigation, the imposition of costs is not a violation of free speech rights. If this court has no further questions, I will yield the remainder of my time to the counsel for the City of Broomfield. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is David Keeter. I'm here on behalf of the City and County of Broomfield. I'm joined by Harvey Curtis and Sheila Stack, also on behalf of Broomfield. The Water Court found below that Broomfield was the prevailing party and awarded costs in the amount of $33,825.79. Responsive to some of the questions earlier, the court found Broomfield only claimed costs that were incurred after the last other objector had settled in the case a few days before trial, and so those costs only account for a few days of trial preparation and then the trial itself, which was necessitated by Franco being the as Mr. Curtis represented it, at the cost hearing, the last man standing at the trial. So there is no Mr. Acolch's hypothetical about engineering reports and huge amounts of costs is simply a hypothetical, and there is no as-applied relevance to this case. Franco has not challenged the court's determination that Broomfield was the prevailing party or the amount or reasonableness of the costs that have been assessed in this matter. In addition to the constitutional claims, its only claim on appeal is that it is exempt from costs because it has municipal shareholders. This argument is contrary to plain language of the rule and contrary to established precedent upholding cost awards against mutual ditch companies. Rule 54D provides costs against the state of Colorado, its officers or agencies shall be imposed only to the extent permitted by law. The Water Court correctly ruled that because Franco is not an officer or agent of the state, even though it may have municipal shareholders, Rule 54D exempting the state and its political subdivisions from the rewards of cost does not apply to Franco. The only entities which have been previously determined by this court to be exempt from costs in Water Court proceedings have been municipalities or entities that are explicitly designated by statute as political subdivisions of the state.
By time. Counsel, I guess let me stop you there. You would concede, I guess, that the members of the mutual ditch company fall into the categories that you were about to describe.
We do not dispute that Franco has municipal shareholders. Broomfield is a municipal shareholder of Franco.
Right. So in other words, the shareholders, or at least a large number of them, would be exempt if they were litigating on their own.
Yes, and in this case, many of them did. Several municipalities, the cities of Thornton and Westminster, and also several special districts who are shareholders in Franco, participated in the proceedings on their own behalf.
And then let me ask you, I mean, Mr. Acol didn't really make this argument. I think he would make it this way, which is, if you cannot impose costs directly on a municipality, how can you do it indirectly by imposing it upon a mutual ditch company?
Under Jacobucci, the relationship between a shareholder and a mutual ditch corporation is one of contract. The contract is inferred by the acquisition of stock and is interpreted according to the bylaws and articles of the corporation. Because under statute, the mutual ditch company can levy assessments on stock for payment of any indebtedness of the company by becoming shareholders in the company and by acquiring stock in Franco. These municipal shareholders have agreed to place themselves in the same position and subject to the same limitations and liabilities as every other shareholder.
So they basically have agreed to it.
That under the implied contract, yes.
And that goes along with the analysis that it's a proprietary capacity, right? I mean, they're acquiring interests in a private company, right? Therefore, they have to contribute to the company's well-being, right? And I'm assuming that costs that Franco would have to pay are going to be handed up in effect by the shareholders, right?
I would agree with that. This court has previously expressed some disquiet with the analytical soundness of the proprietary versus governmental capacity. So I'm not commenting on sort of rigid classification way. But
it has not totally disappeared.
Right.
But to answer the question, this $34,000 will be basically paid by municipalities. How much is the municipal interest in the Franco company right now in terms of percentage?
I don't know. That was not...
Over 50%?
I actually don't know, because Franco is set up in several divisions, and the affidavit that Franco presented for its factual predicate set forth some of the percentages in some of the of its divisions, but did not spell all the information out. But we don't believe that that factual predicate is necessary for determination of this issue.
Well, I'm just pointing out, I believe that the people that will actually bear the cost of this costs payment includes the municipalities, right? They're not exempt from
it
anting up to pay for that.
We would agree with that. As Mr. Wallace mentioned, costs have previously been assessed against mutual ditch companies in the very same cases where this court has determined that state entities were exempt. In Franco v. Golden case, the court, and in the same paragraph that the court determined that the municipal entities were exempt from costs, the court determined that Franco and other mutual ditch companies in that case were private entities which were not exempt from the costs. As also discussed by Mr. Wallace previously, the exemption of the state from the award of costs derives from the concept of governmental immunity. Under the Governmental Immunity Act, mutual ditch companies do not qualify as public entities which are entitled to protection from tort liability. And to follow up on an earlier question, under Chief Directive 0601 of this court, the state is in fact exempted from filing fees and court costs, and the private entities such as a mutual ditch company are not entitled to that particular exemption. Similarly, the fact that Franco has municipal shareholders does not somehow qualify it for the rights and privileges of the sovereign. To address the argument that Franco acts in a representational capacity for its shareholders, this does not make Franco a political subdivision, agency, or officer of the state entitled to the freedom from cost and litigation. The court in Jacobucci acknowledged that the interests of the mutual ditch corporation are not always identical to those of the individual shareholders. And in Jacobucci, when the court determined that the shareholders were the real parties in interest, it required that those shareholders be joined separately into the condemnation proceeding at issue in that case. So when that supports and is indicative that the interests of the corporation acting as the mutual ditch company are not necessarily always directly in line with those of its shareholders, and as a shareholder of Franco, Broomfield in this matter would not particularly believe that Franco was advancing its interests. Finally, the other cases cited by Franco address only the application of corporate law principles to mutual ditch companies. The cases provide no argument for that mutual ditch companies somehow take on the governmental character of their shareholders as a private nonprofit corporation. Consistent with this court's prior ruling in Franco versus Golden, Franco is not exempt from the imposition of litigation costs under Rule 54B, and the water court's ruling should be upheld. Finally, I'll turn briefly to Broomfield's request for attorney's fees on appeal. As discussed, Franco's arguments are contrary to the established precedent, and Franco's attempted to raise arguments which were not raised previously in the trial court. As a result, Franco's appeal lacks substantial justification, and Broomfield respectfully requests that this court award Broomfield its attorney's fees for this appeal. If there are no further questions, thank you.
On behalf of the court, I want to thank all the counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted.